Thanks for agreeing to take this interview. I've been giving your book a read, and it's great fun. You really got this novel feel to the thing going, and it reads like fiction. And I wonder if you could start by telling us why that is and how you decided to make it read like fiction.
Okay. Yeah. Well, first of all, thanks a lot for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. One of the reasons it really has that feel of a novel is because I had just finished my master's degree, my Master of Fine Arts in fiction, doing a creative writing program. So, as soon as I finished my degree, I received this academic grant to come to Venezuela to write a book. And I had initially actually planned to write a novel of historic fiction. So my goal was to sort of create a book that would sort of show modern Venezuela. And because I had been there as a high school student in the 80s, in 1988, I wanted something that would sort of show that transition from the oil boom years of the 70s up to, the Caracazo, the violence of 1989, then through the economic collapse of the 90s, and then into Chavez. So I had all these sort of great ideas of how this should work. It was going to be sort of like a Salman Rushdie's Midnight Children. It's sort of how that book is very much a metaphorical piece for all of India. I was thinking that along those lines. And then, of course, I arrive in Venezuela in September of 2002. Of course, that was such an important time for Venezuela. Fall of 2002, the coup has happened in April. I wasn't there, I missed it. But I arrive, and there's this huge confrontation battle going on between the Chavez administration and the opposition. This is when really the opposition is at its height. You got this media war going on. You've got Chavez, the state-run television station VTV, and through his national broadcast saying, "Okay, the world is this color." And then on the other side, you've got the opposition media and people saying, "No, the world is this color." And the sort of back and forth is a very surreal experience for me. But the point I'm making is that all this was going on, all this really incredible, intense stuff was going on. It was so loud, so overbearing that I'm like, it was really impossible for me to sort of go back and research the 70s or research what was going on in the 80s when this was obviously so important, so historic, and so pressing. So that's when I kind of abandoned the idea of writing a novel because it seemed ridiculous to sort of embellish on reality when what was going on was so fascinating and intense. From that point, my issue was, okay, what do I choose to represent Venezuela? What would be sort of this event that would encapsulate everything that was going on? And pretty quickly, I decided that the most important thing was the coup, and that single event could sort of represent everything I thought I needed, to talk about over a generation or 20, 20, 30 years. I hope you weren't looking for short answers.
No, absolutely not.
Coming back to Venezuela in 2002, I was very kind of suspicious of most information I got. And being there at that time, you've got people saying such contradictory things. The idea of the book is just to really throw the reader into it, to show, the events. So what happened was on April 11th, there was a huge, massive opposition rally against Chavez. And we can safely say over 500,000 people, many people speculate it was close to 1 million people. What happened was this rally decided to go to the Palace of Miraflores. So what happened is there's a gunfight, there's a big firefight. It was very unclear who was shooting at who. A lot of the media coverage focused on blaming what happened, the violence on Chavez, and that sparked a military revolt, and Chavez was ousted from power. So the book really just throws you into that. I begin right there in the morning of April 11th, out in the street in the march, and the idea was just to show and not tell, because I feel that most of the books about Venezuela are trying to tell you how you should feel about it. They're trying to say, okay, this is the kind of person Chavez is. This is the way the opposition is. My idea was just to say, okay, I'm going to let the reader do a lot more of the interpreting of what's going on here. And in that way, I think it's much more of an adventure because it sort of represents what it's like to go to another country, what it feels like to visit a place, not really be sure exactly what's going on, but to be excited by that and that not knowing. And in each chapter, I kind of give you a little bit more background on what's going on so that by the middle of the book, you feel like, okay, I understand what's really going on here. But and then I can sort of up the ante and keep adding sort of layers of complexity. So that was my idea with how I was going to set up the book.
I think it's really fascinating because there's something there for everybody. You've clearly pitched it in a way that somebody who is just browsing through a bookstore and doesn't really know anything about Venezuela can pick it up and not be completely lost by it. But you've also, you know, you've thrown a lot of bones to us hardcore fans. I mean, it's full of little details that, you know, I've been reading about April 11th for years, and mm-hmm. I didn't know that people were going around putting on like lipstick for war paint in the Chavista rallies just outside Miraflores. And to me, this was absolutely fascinating. These little details about what stuck out in people's minds and what people remembered. So I thought it would be interesting to hear how you went about gathering this mass of detail.
Yeah, yeah. And that was fun. Yeah, I really found that to be kind of a rewarding part, is being able to sort of put all these little details together. I was lucky in a lot of ways because of my background, having been in Venezuela in 1988. I built a lot of good relationships that year, and I came back to Venezuela as often as I could, met oftentimes at least once a year, sometimes multiple times in a year. And I was lucky because by the time I came back to do the research for the book, my friends had sort of diverged into the separate camps. So I had a group of good friends who were in the opposition camp and a group of good friends who were in the pro-Chavez camp. And luckily, some of them were in important positions of influence in both those camps. So they were very helpful in getting me connected with people. And as you know, in Venezuela, if you don't know someone and they're a complete stranger, there's a distance there. There's a lot of distance. But when you know someone who knows that person, you know, you're in. They're very accommodating. So I was very lucky to have that. And of course, one of the other things is that there's so much footage out there. You can actually go and watch stuff. There were dozens of news crews there on the streets that day. There were scores of photographers. There's plenty of other accounts. And it was interesting, for example, you mentioned the lipstick. I'd had a couple people mention this, that they'd seen this. And then I actually was able to go back and look closely at some of the images that were there. And you could actually see that some of the people had done that, and you could see it in the photographs. So that was really interesting. And of course, each person I met, I was like, oh, are there other people that you would recommend I talk to? And that sort of ballooned very quickly and got me so much sort of intimate details about what was going on.
Because the method of the book is actually is quite particular. It seems like you just did a hell of a lot of interviewing. And mm-hmm. and it's very detailed, and I see it well because one of the people that you cite, of course, is me, and so I can see that you are very, very careful to just keep the kind of the feel of the language and to just kind of quote large sections to kind of mimic the way that people talk and to mirror the mm-hmm. feelings very precisely. Can you tell us why you chose to do it that way?
Yeah, I mean, part of it is, as you sort of mentioned before, I wanted this to sort of reach a big audience. I didn't want to write any sort of thing that felt like a textbook or felt too expository. And I wanted to let people just speak for themselves. And I found that most of the time, you know, I of course have feelings about what happened, but 9 times out of 10, I had met with someone who voiced what I wanted to say. So it wasn't really necessary for me to feel like, okay, I have to sort of bring my authorial voice in here. And also, I think it adds a higher level of legitimacy. With a country like Venezuela that is so polarized, there's a great risk in writing about it, because if the reader sees you being biased and immediately in your text, then you've potentially alienated, you know, half your audience. So I was really trying to balance things as much as I possibly could so that everyone would feel that their viewpoints were expressed at some place or another throughout the text.
Yeah, you don't show your hand very often, and again, you do give us all this fascinating and kind of deeply fulfilling detail. I just want to mention a couple of the things that I found reading through it that I didn't know and that grabbed me. First, I had no idea that Casa Militar had tried to stop Luis Fernandez from filming from that rooftop, and that there was a guy there, and that there was this moment of bravado where he kind of had to face down Casa Militar, and the guy whimpered off. How, en qué cabeza cabe? How is that possible?
That story is really interesting because they did it twice. He's up there on this rooftop. He's in this very heart of the pro-Chavez crowd. People have seen him come into this building. He's been heckled. His whole crew has been heckled as they come up. And he can see everything, which is why he was so important that day, because he could see all of the events and film anything he wanted. But of course, there's other people, military people on the other rooftops who can see him. So they send over a very young soldier first, and he's able to sort of bluff him, you know, because the soldier doesn't want to feel like the young soldier doesn't want to feel like he's breaking the law. So Fernandez acts like he's live, which he isn't, right? He's actually has to tape what's going on, but he acts like it's a live feed, and that his rights are being broken because the military is trying to violate his freedom of speech, and it works. And it's interesting, that moment's interesting because the moment that he's out of camera range, Luis Fernandez kind of pursues the young officer. At the moment he's out of camera shot, the young soldier turns around and throws him against the wall. So it shows kind of the power of the media, but also, you know, how kind of tenuous it is. The moment you're off camera, then it's a whole different story.
You're exposed. You're
Yeah.
exposed. But what gets me is that Casa Militar very clearly knew that he was there, because later on we got this story that Luis Fernandez had kind of magically gotten this footage, and nobody knew he was there.
You know, people who could see them, but I think it also is a little bit of a testimony to how sort of unorganized things were. Everybody was kind of it was very chaotic. So even though certain members of the Casa Militar could see him from their vantage point on top of the White Palace, which is next door, they were unorganized and sort of in successfully getting him off. So it wasn't until the second attempt, when they came back later, that they were able to get him off. And then only worked because some of the other pro-Chavez people who were on the rooftop with him began to pull at the cables of his video equipment, and he lost power. So he eventually gave up. Yeah. But
Okay.
yeah, there's a lot of really fascinating stories. Of course, the one that really was sort of like a windfall for me was getting access to the doctors at Vargas
Right.
Hospital.
Right.
Because they at first were not interested at all in being interviewed. And it was only after going back repeatedly and talking to the directors of the hospital that they slowly kind of opened up. But once they did, of course, they provided some of the most fascinating, you know, images of the day, you know, these hospitals that were completely swamped with wounded, very low on supplies, and how they had to manage through this sort of incredible chaos and blood.
These people didn't even have toner for the printers.
Yeah, tone. And in fact, they wouldn't have had things like X-ray plates and a lot of other supplies if Dr. Sibernescu, the head of the emergency medicine there, hadn't quietly been hoarding supply because they were so well on supplies. He knew that if something catastrophic happened like this, then they would have been unable to help people. And he told me in our interview, actually, he said that if that happened now, if there was another April 11th, he said that the hospital would not be able to save nearly as many people because they just do not have the resources that they had then.
There is a tension, I think, between your role as historian and your role as guardian of the stories, because you're clearly trying to safeguard people's memories on the one hand, and also to push forward a narrative that will be entertaining and interesting to your readers. But then you also have a third audience of people like me, or the people who read my blog, who are the Venezuelan politics junkies, who are very thirsty to have a kind of definitive historical version
Right.
of what happened. And your book is trying to do all three, as far as I can tell.
Yeah. To some degree, and I think I mentioned this a little bit before, is that the one of the reasons I was very excited about using multiple perspectives is that it kind of lets you filter through. I mean, there's certain times in the book when I know that some of the stuff the characters are saying that they legitimately feel don't sort of coincide with reality. Some of the more militant members that are close to Chavez, some of saying that Vasco Velasco, for example, is a fascist, something I think you might have mentioned in your take on April 11th, that when you juxtapose that next to what Vasco Velasco actually says, it doesn't quite jive. Also, for example, the fact that many people felt that there was a plot by the United States to take Chavez out of Venezuela and put him in prison in the United States. While it's true that that did happen with Manuel Noriega, I think it's clear as you read this that that probably was not in the cards.
So you just let people read this, come to these conclusions
Have I intentionally misled people?
themselves.
Well, I guess to some degree I want to let the person, the reader, kind of figure it out.
Yeah.
If that is legitimately how that character felt, then that's their point of view, and that becomes part of the story. And that's actually April 11th, and I think this is a little bit clearer in my conclusion. Disinformation and misinformation is actually also part of the story. That there was a very well-orchestrated plan to rewrite the history of this. Okay, so for me to ignore all of that body of information about the rewriting of it is sort of to miss part of the story, because the spin, which really both sides have tried to put spin on what happened, eventually becomes part of the history.
Okay, there's a lot I want to ask you about. I think it's very clear when you're dealing with the march on the 11th, and it's a very thorough take and a very personal take also, because it's from the points of view of the participants. You never really attempt to stand back from it and tell the what happened, just many what happens. But you do at one point break with that yourself. You allow yourself this one paragraph, which I'm going to read. It's important to note that the police did not try to take the Llaguno overpass or completely drive back the armed Chavez supporters. Instead, they stayed between the two groups, acting as a buffer, returning selective fire at the armed Chavistas. This is significant because the police were by far the largest armed force on the scene, with over 1,000 officers compared to fewer than 200 National Guardsmen. If the police had really resolved to push back the Chavez supporters so that the march could reach Miraflores, as the Chavez regime would later claim, they could have easily done so. Moreover, if the police had been involved in such a conspiracy, they would not have blocked and tear gassed the march on Bolivar Avenue before it reached El Silencio. They also would not have picked Baralta Avenue to launch such an assault, because Urdaneta Avenue, and hence Miraflores, is accessible only on foot from Baralta Avenue, and their most important asset, the armed police trucks, couldn't pass that way. Now, I think that's a very important set of arguments, but they are arguments. So the paragraph felt both necessary and slightly at odds with the rest of the book. So why is it there?
I very much felt exactly what you're saying, is that I got to a point where I felt like if I don't say this, it's going to be a liability to the book. Because from my research, and not to toot my own horn too much, but few people understand this as well as I do. And this is one of the points, moments where I'm like, well, I can't let it go that people might get the wrong impression about what's going on here. So I felt I had to sort of step in and say, look, this is what I think, as someone who is through this research and expert, this is what happened. And it should not be interpreted as the police being the instigators or in cahoots with any kind of rebellion against Chavez, simply because they put themselves between the two groups. And to not do that, I felt would be a disservice and would lead to something that was false, an idea that was false about what had happened. So I wanted to show what the people on the street felt, that perhaps, okay, these policemen here are trying to push through, that from the pro-Chavez side, it felt like they were being attacked by the police. But we have to remember, these are armed people who have decided to use violence and shoot on the march. So I thought it was too important to not sort of break with the alternative perspective, and I felt I had to sort of step in.
One thing that this part of the tale about April 11th shows very clearly is that from a kind of naive perspective afterwards, you kind of have a feeling that there were about as many casualties on the pro-Chavez and on the anti-Chavez side. Mm-hmm. But what your narrative makes very clear is that while that might be true, they were not uniformly spaced over the length of the afternoon, and that you seem to have many more anti-Chavez casualties at the beginning of the confrontation, and people falling on Avenida Oralte and mm-hmm. Marina Besate and all these people kind of falling, dropping like flies until the armored police vehicles come in. But it's also quite clear from what you say that that's the point when you start getting many more pro-Chavez casualties, which goes a long way to explaining the feeling that Chavisa-san had about what the police was doing there.
Right. Yeah, so, I mean, if you think about these two groups, they're clashing. Malvina, Jorge Tortosa, and a bunch of other people are shot. At that point, the police do step in, and at that point, the casualties on the opposition side drop off dramatically because there's much more space between the two factions. When the police, who are receiving pretty heavy fire, reinforce themselves with sharpshooters by the late afternoon, then that's the point when you're getting a lot of the pro-Chavez casualties, because they're shooting on those armed people, but also I'm sure they're not always hitting, and there's definitely some misses, some people who are hitting unintentionally, or, you know, we can't really say, be too sure about, you know, what happened in that chaotic moment. But yeah, there's very, very much two sort of separate violent periods. The first part is when most of the anti-Chavez people are hurt, and the second is when the pro-Chavez people are hurt very late in the afternoon. And that's closer to when the footage from the Puente Aguina gunman was taken.
Well, I'm not going to ask you any of the obvious questions, because I'm not going to uh-huh. force you to tell us that you don't know who started shooting. But do you?
Well, yeah, I think it's pretty clear. The police took a lot of measures to make sure that the march didn't even get this far. The pro-Chavez group that had congregated around Miraflores was ready and prepared for violence. And what started off as sort of a clash of rocks and sticks between the two groups, the pro-Chavez side, feeling very overwhelmed because they were extremely outnumbered, began shooting. At that point, most of the police were actually on the next street over. They came over to reinforce that area when it was reported that there were shots fired. At that point, the gap between the two groups expanded and the opposition casualties dropped off. But the firing continued at that point, mostly now at the police, okay? And the police began to return fire on the pro-Chavez supporters. And that, later in the afternoon, that's when they received most of their wounded. So for the perspective of, if you go back and look at the perspective of Carlos Giordia, who's on the next street over, he hears the gunshots from Baralt Avenue. And that's when the police that were sort of blocking the way for his group to get to Miraflores, that's when they all head over to Baralt. And at that point, his group pushes up against a small amount of National Guard troops that are left.
So are you telling me that you don't have any evidence of northbound gunfire before the police trucks arrive there?
No. And that's one of the things, if you go back and look at all the footage and the photographs, I can show you dozens of photographs of gunmen, approach Chavez gunmen shooting downward on Barón Avenue. I can show you plenty of photos of police officers later in the day shooting back up, but I cannot show you any images of any anti-Chavez gunmen. Okay, that's not to say there aren't any. You know, we all know that a lot of people in Venezuela carry guns, and it is possible that there might have been some retaliation by a few individuals, but there's nothing that was orchestrated, and there's just no evidence there. And again, the material is there for anyone to go see and look at if they want. The video footage, the photographs, and there's just none of it. There's no footage of anti-Chavez gunmen shooting, and there's the only people who are shooting at the pro-Chavez crowd are the police officers.
It does appear to be what is coming out of your stories, but out of your witness statements, but it's just not quite as categorical as the way you're making it now.
No, but I mean that if it's there, I'll put the evidence in. You know, I'm not I'm it's just that you know, the same with the influence of the United States. If I find if someone can come out and show me hard evidence of U.S. complicity in the coup, I will more than happy to put it in the book in a later edition. And the same with if you can show me anti-Chavez person shooting at the march, I'll put it in there. I'm not if I can see it, I'll do it. You know, I'm not trying to poison the well here or influence it one way or the other.
I want to ask you a little bit about the collapse of the regime later on that day, because another thing that your book does well on is just having a very specific sense of the chronology, the very confused chronology of that afternoon, and who knew what where. We do get the sense that in that Fuerte Tiuna was a few hours behind the curve. So the information was not filtering down to them, and that in a way they were finding out things along with everyone else on the tube. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely, absolutely. And one of the things about the book, and one of the things that in some ways protects me as a writer by using point of view, is that sometimes you can be a little bit skeptical of point of view. So sometimes at certain points, I'm somewhat skeptical of how far behind they were and when it kind of behooves them to be a little bit far behind. The case would be the primary case would be sort of General Vasquez Velasco, who I think if you sort of read between the lines in the testimony that he gave in his section of the book. He was behind the curve, but then also I don't think he wanted to act. He didn't know what to do. He's the head of the army. Chavez is trying to reach him. He knows that Chavez will probably ask him to call out the army to suppress the march, something that he knows is illegal, but then something that he also knows he'll probably be blamed for if there are deaths. Like there were the last time that this plan was activated, which was 1989. So in that section of the book, there I think you can kind of feel him sort of okay. I am behind the curve, but maybe I also don't want to act because I'm afraid I don't know how to handle the situation. So in the end, it wasn't till much later in the evening, I think after he had actually given a press conference saying that he was not going to follow any orders from Chavez, that he finally did speak to Chavez. So, and that's another thing to re remember, because yes, legitimately there was a delay. And there is a lot of, think about people in Venezuela sitting in their living rooms. A lot of this information was not coming in as clearly as it comes out in the book. So the reader of the book actually has a much better feel for when things were happening and why than people who are actually there that day. And that's one of the kind of the magic things about doing multiple perspective is that you understand, there's comes a point where you, as the reader, understand events much better than any individual who was there, even someone like Chavez or General Vasquez Velasco or General Rosendo. You have much more information than any of those characters do.
That's right. That's right. But it, in a strange way, that could be seen as almost distorting the story also, insofar as the reader has, it's much easier for the reader to see what is happening that
Right,
way. It's unavoidable,
exactly.
isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, I try to sort of remind people that of that. For example, I show Chavez's resignation, the point from which he knows that the military leaders don't want to follow his orders anymore, to all of the press conferences. I show that twice. I show it as up to his like resignation, really. I show it the way that it was perceived by anybody watching TV. You sort of saw, okay, Chavez is in trouble. All these people are denouncing him. The military won't follow his orders. Luis Mikiléinis and his other supporters are also abandoning him. It looks like he's going to turn himself over to the military. Okay, he does turn himself over to the military. It's announced that he's willing to resign. I show that twice. I show that, and then I go back and say, okay, but this is what really happened. In an effort to sort of say, okay, there's two ways that this was. Actually, that there was one way that it was perceived by the people, and then the other thing is what really happened.
I understand. Let me ask you a little bit about the role. It's one of these perennial questions about April 11th that, it's a parlor game that will never end, is what was happening with Lucas Rincón, who famously was the one to, and the highest ranking officer in the armed forces and the one to announce Chavez's resignation. You paint a somewhat confusing picture of what was happening between those 2 big years of his. Maybe you can describe your experience of trying to piece together Lucas Rincón's role, does this?
Absolutely. This is an extremely important character. This is someone who was handpicked by Chavez to be his highest ranking officer. His title is the Inspector General of the Armed Forces. He is the one who famously announces that Chavez has accepted the military's terms and that he intends to resign. So this was the news event that people all over Venezuela and even the world took as the gospel, because to have, this come from Lucas Rincón would be sort of like Dick Cheney announcing that President Bush has resigned. You wouldn't doubt that there's any sort of manipulation behind it. So according to Rincón's testimony, however, that night there was a lot of fear within the palace that it would be attacked, that there were these a group of people within the military who had prepared for an armed strike against the palace. While there isn't any concrete evidence that that was ever true, we do know that there were some valid coup plots within the military. We know about Admiral Hector Ramirez Perez. We know that Chavez was very suspicious of General Medina Gomez, who was the attaché to Washington. So we know that within Miraflores, they were very worried about a military strike. And we know from other testimony that they were setting up anti-tank weapons, rocket launchers, getting ready for the siege after the violence had died down, because they felt that this was the moment that the military would strike. And of course, again, the reason that they one of the reasons they felt that way was because Chavez, Hugo Chavez, being someone who actually led a coup once, he felt that when he was making his plans for his coup, he intended to do it at that time. He wanted some sort of civic event that would sort of help him precipitate the coup so then he could consolidate power. So this is the thinking of the leaders within Miraflores that night, that if there's going to be a military attack, it's going to be now. So Lucas Rincón, and I actually believe this is true, even and this is what he said in his congressional testimony, was that he announced the resignation in order to kind of defuse that situation. He said, "Well, if I announce that Chavez is going to resign, then that will defuse the situation, and we won't have to worry about a military strike because the military will have gotten what they wanted."
But notice that you also have Lucas Rincón earlier in the evening, so I think 8 p.m. if I'm following that correctly. More or less stalling Chavez on Plan Ávila.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's something that
Absolutely.
has not permeated into the kind of consciousness about the coup of either side, as far as I can tell.
Right, absolutely. Plan Avila, ordering Plan Avila, which basically should only be, according to the Constitution, is only, is basically almost declaring martial law for people who aren't really familiar with it. But it calls out people, the army into the street to take complete control. And Venezuelans know Plan Avila from 1989 because when Carlos Andrés Pérez gave the order to do it, we had the Catacazo, where at least 800 people were killed, and many believe many more. So, having been there during the Catacazo, I remember very distinctly that you did not go out after curfew. If you did, you were likely to be shot, and many people were, simply just for being out of doors after curfew. So no one in the military wanted to touch Plan Avila. It doesn't seem that any of the generals that Chavez sort of pushed it to, except for Jorge Carniero, wanted to have anything to do with it. So he sort of went down the chain of command. He went down to Lucas Rincon first, who stalled. Then he went to General Rosendo, who flatly refused. Then he was trying to reach Vasquez Velasco,
Wouldn't pick
and
up the
Vasquez
phone.
Velasco. Sorry?
He wouldn't pick up the phone.
Yeah, he wouldn't pick up the phone. So you can see the higher ranking military officers completely not wanting to go there in the colloquial. They did not want to have anything to do with this. So and that was very interesting. And I was surprised that it didn't seem that many people had realized that Rincon had also refused Plan Avila. But it's actually Chavez says it himself when he's being interviewed the next day. When he's under arrest, he's complaining about how the army didn't respond to him, and he clearly says that I told Rincon to implement Plan Avila, and he stalled. So I think that's an interesting point that I was surprised wasn't more, a lot of people didn't seem to know about.